Seeking God, the truth about God, has been an important part of my life. Several months ago, an incident occurred that almost drew that pursuit to an end. Either a heart attack or blood clots, the nurse informed me, as I wheeled into a room for tests at Sarasota Memorial Hospital. Pulmonary embolisms, blood clots, were found in every entry to my lungs. Injected with all kinds of needles, it was touch and go that evening. A real possibility of imminent death. While in seminary, I had worked as a chaplain at the Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston on weekends. It was there I learned psychological distress is very common in fatally ill persons. Some tried to deny what was happening. I recall one man found it impossible to accept the situation. Another one blamed everyone else, including God, for his condition. Some were unable to stop crying. Many wanted forgiveness, but the overwhelming number were terrified of what was to become of them after death. It appears the fear of extinction has always been with us. Archaeologists unearthing graves have discovered some kind of belief in a future world among the Neanderthals. Think about it. Isn't the promise of more life beyond the grave the very foundation of most religions? Raised a Catholic, I was taught that if I obeyed all the rules and regulations of that faith, I would be rewarded with heaven after death. Privileged, only we Catholics were awarded this salvation from hell. Nevertheless, it wasn't easy for us. If we ate a hamburger on a Friday, hell was our destination until we confessed that sin to a priest. Skipping Sunday Mass was unthinkable. And when it came to sex, well, if Catholics had anything else on their mind but procreating, they were in deep, deep trouble. Actually, hell was the stick, heaven was the carrot, with heart-strumming angels and reunions with loved ones for most Christian churches. But Christianity is not alone. Imagine, if you will, a young man gets on a bus headed for the city. He sits next to a middle-aged couple. New passengers get on the bus. The bus is full. The young man smiles. He presses a button and destroys himself, the couple at his side, and 20 others on the bus, as well as many other casualties in the street. All went according to plan. He was assured of 20 virgins in heaven. It's easy to guess that young man's religion. Our beliefs are important. Your beliefs move almost everything in your life. Are you a Muslim, a Jew, Buddhist, Hindu, Christian, Unitarian? Are you an atheist? Your beliefs define your vision of the world. They dictate your behavior, determine your emotional response. The more I studied, the more I began to abandon many of the beliefs of my childhood. In the very beginning, Christians lived communally, sharing all they had with each other. They were pacifists. Reminds me of Lenin's Imagine, doesn't it? But in the 300s AD, when Christianity became the national religion under Constantine, and the Bible as we know it today was put together, nonviolence was wiped out of that faith. Religion became, to a great extent, a self-serving strategy as vast lands came under Constantine's control with the addition of those Christian soldiers. The popes in 1000 AD promised the crusaders paradise in return for liberating Jerusalem. It is said that the massacre of the Muslims was so great that the blood spilled was up to the knees of the soldiers. No 20 virgins, but a straight ride to heaven was good enough for those crusaders. Using God's name to condone behavior continues to this day. Nabil Shaath, who was Palestinian foreign minister at the time, revealed, "President Bush said to all of us, 'I am driven with a mission from God. God would tell me, George, go and fight these terrorists in Afghanistan.' And I did. And then God would tell me, 'George, go and end the tyranny in Iraq.' And I did. George Bush's family, as well as the corporations that backed him, secured billions of dollars from those wars at the price of thousands of U.S. and allied soldiers, as well as over 100,000 Iraqi lives, primarily women, children, and the elderly." The New York Times just reported several weeks ago that ISIS has formed groups of kidnapped young women to serve as sex slaves to ISIS members, declaring it to be the will of God. Raping these women, even children, was to be performed as a holy ritual, pleasing to God, with prayer before and after the act. It is thought that ISIS added this bonus to recruit more Muslim members, since the Orthodox religion disavows any premarital sex. In the name of God, look at the millions of dollars they have gained as they capture oil fields and sell off what they claim to be the antiquities of the infidels. It goes on and on. How sick is all of this? I went through an agonizing struggle with the separation from the exclusionism of the Catholic Church to a denomination that didn't rely on dogma, the United Methodist Church. But then my readings led me to the fallacies within the Bible itself. It was in seminary I began to study on my own the many origins of the biblical stories in pagan history. Creation was an almost word-for-word plagiarism from the Egyptians. Only the names were changed. Noah's Ark came from Mesopotamia, Lucifer from the Canaanites. Many Old Testament stories were very recognizable in a variety of ancient religions. The New Testament didn't fare very well either. The life of Jesus appears to have originated from many old myths, too many similarities to ignore. India's Krishna as far back as 1400 BCE, the Horus myth of ancient Egypt, Mithra and Zoroaster of Persia, and others were all born in a cave by a virgin. They all performed miracles. Some even had the Lord's Supper. They all rose from the dead. There are many more similarities and many more similar myths. You can actually Google them now. Joseph Campbell, the great American student of ancient mythology, observed that most people have no difficulty seeing the mythological elements in a religious system other than their own. The problem, he suggested, comes when looking at one's own traditions. Once you see your own religion as myth, he asserted, it dies. How could I have continued to become an ordained Christian minister? I sincerely felt that working within the organization, I could achieve more changes than outside its sphere. I believe the world desperately needed changing. If churches would only teach love for the other, we could transform the world. History teaches us Religion is exactly that powerful. As a pastor, I would teach this basic assertion of almost all religions. This law, this rule, as you can see, was not only the Christian's golden rule. It can be found in Confucianism. It appears prominently in Islam, Hinduism, Buddhism, Taoism, Judaism, Zoroastrianism, and the rest of the world's major religions. They all have one aspect in common: the demand that people treat others in a manner in which they themselves would like to be treated. Well, I tried my best. It's a lot harder for a pastor than you can ever imagine. I had wondered through the years if I would retreat to my Catholic roots and demand a priest for that last confession when faced with death, just in case. Heaven, nirvana, reincarnation, the transmigration of souls are the ground of most religions, and frankly, I was not immune to the hope of living on. But then again, I had read Bishop Spong, the rebellious Episcopal bishop and best-selling author. He had studied the concept of life after death for 5 years and finally determined that he would never speculate on its truth. On that subject, he put away his books. That says a lot. Well, Bishop Spong, by the way, a favorite of mine, will be visiting our church in February, and I'm really looking forward to it. Well, that night in the hospital, I reviewed all those voices in my head. God? Question mark. Well, from all my readings during and after seminary, believe it or not, John Lennon's words are the ones that really spoke to me. I believe in God. Or better yet for me, I believe in something. But not as one thing, not as an old man in the sky. I believe that what people call God is something in all of us. I believe that what Jesus and Mohammed and Buddha and all the rest said was right. It's just that the translations have gone wrong. After World War II, a brilliant, high-ranking Catholic theologian, German Karl Rahner, refused to use the word God, a word that he believed caused more bloodshed than any other. He renamed God the ultimate mystery, using the horizon line as a description. We see it, but of course can never reach it. I embrace that. Using Karl Rahner's method of replacing the word for God, after a great deal of thought, I replaced it with the word love. The unifying word found in all religions. You see, I still clung to a meaning for our lives. I still desired justice. I don't know. But somehow I believe those filled with love are filled with what we call God. Does believing that love might be the defining essence of the ultimate mystery place me among the many agnostics, perhaps, but does it really matter? Bishop Spong ultimately wrote us his answer to his research on life after death. Let us live. Let us even eat, drink, and be merry, not because tomorrow we shall die, but because today we are alive. Well, I added love to his words. Let us live, let us love. Eat, drink, and be merry, not because tomorrow we shall die, but because today we are alive. That was it for me. Not belief in any God, not even belief in Jesus, as so many Christian churches demand, because I just didn't know. Richard Dawkins, the well-known atheist and author of The God Delusion, who in refuting scripture words wrote, "Why do we so readily accept the idea that the one thing you must do if you want to please God is believe in him? What's so special about believing? Isn't it just as likely that God would reward kindness or generosity or humility?" I totally agree with what he wrote. I generally don't know the answer, but I am thrilled to be alive at a time when humanity is pushing against the limits of understanding. Even better, we may eventually discover that there are no limits. Lawrence Krauss in the New York Times bestseller, A Universe from Nothing, about the possibility of nothingness as a source of all being, admitted that nothing is certain. The church is now offering actually a study on this book. Yet in all my readings, I found no one to give actual credible proof of the existence of God, whatever he or she may be called. Several scientists claim the possibility of our human enzyme and our chemical makeup coming together by accident is 1 in 10 to the 40,000th power. But I also found that no one, not even these scientists, could definitely prove that there isn't one either. Not being able to know something for certain does not increase the odds of being true or untrue. Richard Feynman, Nobel Prize recipient, described the laws of physics as an infinitely layered onion. I can live with doubt and uncertainty and not knowing, he wrote. I think it's much more interesting to live not knowing than to have answers which might be wrong. As I lay on that hospital bed several months ago without any tangible answers of my own, I couldn't have been more amazed. What I experienced was not the fear or anger or denial I had witnessed so often as a chaplain on nights like this, and I expected. But instead, a profound peace came over me. What I felt that night is very difficult to understand or to describe. In fact, the closest I found is in the Bible, the peace that surpasses all understanding. Is there life after death? If there is, that will be as exciting for me as the breaking free of the cocoon and flying on beautiful wings. Is there a God? I don't know. Nevertheless, not knowing if I would see it tomorrow, I was still overwhelmingly at peace with the mystery. As I closed my eyes thinking, if there is a God, I'm pretty sure he, she, or it will be love. I woke up the next day. Wow, I'm alive. And now the journey continues. I'm ending my sermon with the Beatles again and their wonderful message. And it's mine too. All you need is love. And join in that chorus too, if you wish.